My name is Janet Hanstead, and the title of this session is A Theology of Peace, the Foundation for Peace Education. Just to tell you a little background about how this session evolved, or how my interest in this evolved, I did some writing and some research last year in Washington, D.C. on peace education. Primarily my interest was militarism, and so I did a four-part study. And the first part dealt with our identity as Christians, the second part with militarism from a global perspective, the third part from specifics about U.S. involvement, and the last section was peace education, and that's what this is. And so I'm going to do a little bit of an overview of some of the introduction things and then talk about ideas, tenets, that's what I called it up here, of a theology of peace, things that a theology of peace in the nuclear age specifically need to embrace or need to include, need to at least look at. This doesn't need to be a lecture type session. I've got all these chicken scratches. If you want to interrupt me, I can figure out where I was again. So please feel free to comment or whatever. Anyway, the first thing that really hit me when I was doing this research was the newness of the age that we're in right now, the distinctiveness, the uniqueness of the nuclear age. There's a lot that can be battled back and forth about militarism and war in general, but there is qualitatively a difference in the age that we live in now as the nuclear age. And some of those things really hit me. One of them is what Alan Geyer calls the year 38. That's the year we're in now, post-Hiroshima. If we start to record time from the beginning of when we've used nuclear weapons, we're in the year 38. From 45, yeah, I guess that's right. So if we look at it in terms of an age, a post-Hiroshima age, we're pretty young in terms of history, but we've got some real significant influences because of the nuclear age. A lot of crisis is going on in the world, and there's a lot of destruction, and we have a lot less security internationally than we have ever had before. And so it's a time of crisis right now, being in the nuclear age, but it's also a time of kairos. Kairos is a Greek word that means a time that's ripe for the interjection of God's activity in human affairs. Well, that's a loose translation, but that's my understanding of it. And so I think it's a really unique time to be living. It's a really scary time, and it's a time when we need to learn what the gospel has to say to us as Christians and what it is that we need to do in response or be in response. That specifically relates to this time. People in every time have to read the gospel and have it affect their lives according to what time they live in, and I think that specifically we need to understand what it means to read the gospel and what is the good news, because we are nuclear age people. Christians in the nuclear age are confronted with issues and questions that no other people in human history have had to deal with. We're the first generation of people, or in a loose sense, post-Hiroshima people, are the first generation of people who have ever had to look at the idea of being so powerful and so rebellious that we can defy the Creator in terms of the Creator's desire and timing and activity in history. We could obliterate all of human history and life on this planet and conceivably abort God's plans, or at least that's one way of looking at it. And no other people in the world, no matter how severe their rebellion or how serious their sin was, had the capacity to do that. And so I think that's one thing that we need to take into account. These things that that the nuclear age calls us to think about, I've categorized into three different areas. First, our identity, who we are as Christians. The second one I wrote calling. Basically, that is, who are we by nature as Christians, and what are we to be about? And the task at hand is, what specific activities are we to be about doing, or things we're looking at? And these are just an overview of the first few sections of my research. The main part is the theology, but I'll just go over some of this real quick. Our identity as creatures and creations of God is something that we get from Scripture, from looking at other people, and from looking at nature. We look at the world around us and see how nature functions. And there's themes that are prevalent that give us a clue to who we are, what kind of creations we are, and who God is, and what kinds of things God wants for the creation. Some of those themes are things like interdependence, community, growth, beauty, resilience. All those things are things that we pick up from nature that we also see in ourselves as human beings, and that we understand God to be like. Symbols from Scripture that come to mind are things like salt and light, where we are creations that are meant to be preserved and guided and to be that to one another. In light of the nuclear age, it's hard to think about not being against or trying to get rid of nuclear weapons, because none of those images that come to us through Scripture or through creation are things that nuclear weapons and nuclear destruction can ever be really reconciled with. There's a quote from, who was it? I think it's Bonino. Well, I'm sorry, anyway, I'm not sure. But that says nuclear weapons are unlimited. Oh, this is in the New Abolitionist Covenant. That's what it is. The nuclear weapons are unlimited in their violence, indiscriminate in their victims, and uncontrollable in their devastation. And so what I'm basically saying is, by their very nature and by our very nature, that we are unreconcilably inimical to each other. The power of nuclear weapons is just destroying in every sense of the word. And that if we look at God as being a creator God, and we understand through Scripture and through the world that God's power is a creative power, then nuclear weapons are about as opposite as you can possibly imagine. Philosophical explanations of war, things like the just war theory, that have been practical and in some ways helpful in the past when dealing with evil and dealing with the concepts of war, at least as far as I'm concerned, are not viable options in the nuclear age. They don't address the evil seriously enough, and the destruction. They cloud the issue with ideas of strategy and rationality, but they don't, they just aren't enough. I think finally we have to concretely say nuclear weapons cannot be included when we think about dealing with international conflict in that way. So for the first part, who we are as Christians from creation, from Scripture, from learning from each other, is just by nature inimical to, nuclear weapons are inimical to who we are and who I understand God to be. The second part, the nature of our being and what we are to be about, is not simply what we're doing, but just what our process is, and that's to be, we're called to be creators with God, to be establishers, encouragers, reconcilers, co-workers in the gospel, messengers of good news, all the kinds of themes that could be labeled peacemaking, bringing in the kingdom, contributing to God's shalom. Those types of things are not things that in any way the use of or even the maintenance of nuclear weapons can contribute to. And for me, if I take this calling seriously in my life to be this kind of a person and to understand my creation that way, then I've got to look at the society that I live in, the communities, the systems which I find myself in, and look at what they mean. A lot of times we hear at Holden do a lot of activities, but we also, I think oftentimes people come in and don't have a sense of why we're doing them. How do we get to where we are? Why are we doing a prayer vigil? It's the action thing, but for me, what needs to happen in between is an understanding of who we are by nature and what we are doing in community with each other. When we do things as a result of the conviction that we are God's people and trying to live out with the kinds of values that we believe in the world, it's hard to look at nuclear weapons and not have my whole understanding of what it is to be in a Christian community and what life is all about challenged and threatened. Also, when you look at the society that we live in, we spend over $600 billion a year right now on armaments, and we recognize that two-thirds of the world are hungry, starving, nutritionally, malnutritious. Yeah?
I read just recently $800 billion for the most recent year.
I think that's projected, but I could be wrong.
I've only heard it from one source that I can't remember right now.
In any case, it's phenomenal.
It's astounding to increase that much in the year.
Yeah.
What was your figure?
600.
And yours was 800. Within a space of 1 year.
Okay. So what I'm saying basically is that given who we are as Christians and the kinds of world we live in, we need to be about the process of looking at those things, evaluating what's going on in our society and where we fit into that. The task at hand is just a way of saying, what is it that we go and do? And basically that's what the rest of the theology of peace is. You can find a lot of hard exegetical surveys and data books are written that talk about who we are as God's people, and you can find the same type of thing that talks about our nature and what we are like and what we aren't like and how much of that is because of God and how much isn't. But what my focus is in trying to think about a theology of peace is to look at what it is that we are to be about and how we are doing that, and that's the task at hand. For me, that is being able to assess the brokenness, the things that tear down society, tear down us as a community of God's people, and having a sense of vision and how to be something different in that world that speaks to a more shalom, a more whole, a more enlivened community. So I'll just move into that. The first aspect of the theology of peace is that creation is fundamentally interdependent and complementary. When we read the creation accounts, creation was good in God's eyes, and it was very independent. All of the things that were created had a reason for being. They were there for the enjoyment and the coexisting of one another. And I think that in order for us to come to an understanding of peace, we've got to look at the world that way, that our community and all of creation are intertwined. There's no way we can separate along national boundaries our allegiance, and that we are complementary. That includes the diversity and differences in culture, but it doesn't exclude any specific part of the world. In creation, the interdependence of creation, the wholeness of creation, was a stated reality, and I think that that's a key factor that we don't think about when we talk about peace, that the reality is that God created the world for wholeness, for unity, for a functioning together that is harmonious, and that that is the reality and that is the norm. And if we don't think, if we don't assume that, then we fragment the world and we function from a fragmented norm instead of a holistic norm. The example that comes to mind most frequently for me is when we talk about economic and political systems, we talk in terms of capitalism, Marxism, social democracy. And to understand in the world, in a worldview that compartmentalizes and defines and almost inevitably has a value judgment and includes the people of the world in those ways, is a fragmenting way to understand the world. It's helpful in some terms, but in some ways of understanding specific issues, but it's not, it's from a Christian point of view, for me, it can't be the final worldview, because we've got to finally call that people in those countries, the people under those different systems, are brothers and sisters, and essentially identify ourselves as related to them. Reagan's kind of good guys, bad guys, communists, non-communists, cowboys and Indians type mentality, I think is really anachronistic, and I think we have to really move away from that. What happens when we compartmentalize is first that it teaches us to think competitively. We view ourselves as good or right when we're number one, when we're the winners, when we're the leaders in hemispheric hegemony. We image leadership in controlling, dominating, and prevailing images. And it's an isolating and a frustrating sort of road to get on. We lose sight of our dependence, our interdependence on the rest of the world. We lose sight of our dependence on the people that we call our enemies. Prime example of that is our foreign policy, because what we are really at the mercy of the people that we are attempting to defend ourselves from, in as much as we hope that they will not, quote, force us to use the power that we know we can project, because maybe we really don't want to use it. And also, we depend on our ability to so terrorize our enemies that they won't even consider using their power, but then at the same time, we rely on their cool-headed rationality in dealing with us in other aspects. And it's a circle of fear that is irrational at best, just because you can't terrorize somebody and then expect for them to deal with you in a way that is consistent with your own expectations. Another thing that happens when we fragment the world and look at it according to boxes is that we lack a sense of cooperation with the rest of the world in human progress, in development, and in history. We see ourselves as a single entity and don't understand ourselves as part of the rest of the human community at this time and in this age. Another reason why team picking and that sort of worldview isn't consistent with God's worldview, the Shalom worldview, is that it gives a false impression of national power. It's idolatrous in a lot of ways, and it's an elusive image. Most of the countries that 20, 30, 40 years ago were small countries and we wouldn't think of in terms of status or prestige, many of them now have the potential, if not already the stated capacity for nuclear weapons. And to think that any nation can control its own destiny is an illusion. We can't stop terrorism. We can't stop small nations like we could before it was a nuclear age, militarily. And the balance of power and alliances are our anachronistic terminology in international conflict resolution because of that. There's no way we can control that, and it's an illusion. The third thing is that it promulgates paradoxes of security. There is a quote I want to read. Richard Barnett, in one of his books, talks about that paradox where we spend so much on security, but then we lose sight of what it is we're trying to protect. Where did it go? Okay, the distortion of priorities has become so acute that as the Reagan administration counsels a massive increase in military spending, essential services in every major American city are being cut. To suggest that the threat of Finlandization in Europe is a greater threat to the people of Chicago, Cleveland, Los Angeles, or Detroit than the loss of social services, the breakdown in the educational system, the rise in crime, the alarming increase in infant mortality, and the impending municipal bankruptcies, the failure to invest in appropriate alternative energy systems, or to revitalize American industry is to distort the meaning of strength. And I think that that is a key factor in dealing with nuclear age issues, is there's a distortion of values. We have put so much into defending that we've lost sight of what it is that is tearing down the fabric of society, that we, the values that we are trying to defend. Okay, the second major tenet of theology of peace is demythologizing. It's learning to have new eyes and new understanding of power and of truth. Alan Geyer is a man who suggested that we need an ironology of the 20th century. We have a mythology about war, and those are often using the ideas and the images of Greek and Roman goddesses from mythology. We name our missiles the Trident, the Hercules, the MX is the Missile X, and there's an aura of mythology. And so Alan Geyer suggested that we need an ironology because Irene was the goddess of peace, the counterpart to the Roman goddess Pax. And that's not that we need a new mythology necessarily, but that our theology of peace needs to be equally as pervasive as the kind of imagery that we have from the Greek and Roman gods.
And Janet, the MX is now called the Peacekeeper.
Yeah, and that's just another example. Yeah, really. And the whole, everything in our society is tainted with some sort of a influence of militarism. If it's not mythological, it's there in other ways. It's in our values. It's in our language. I put up there metaphors. Wish Larry was here. But we say fight the good fight. You could just go on for hundreds of metaphors that all relate to war, and there's just almost no area of our life, at least in this society, that hasn't been colored with images of military might, of prowess, of conquering. Militarism is just gotten in our society in every possible way. And we honor, we have ceremonies to honor heroes. I think we have 20th century mythologies about what it is to be militarily superior. The thing that I think counteracts that we as Christians need to be concerned with is the visionary wisdom that the Bible talks about, the kind of wisdom that Solomon prayed for, the kinds of wisdom in the Bible where we are told to have the wisdom of serpents. What does it mean to be sheep in the midst of wolves? How do we survive in that kind of thing? Jacques Ellul had a statement about being realistic, and he says that the first duty of a Christian is to reject idealism. And then in particular, he goes on to say that the order of violence is like the order of digestion or falling bodies or gravitation. And he claims that in respect to war, that that's realism. And I'd like to suggest that if that's not the kind of realism that our faith leads us to, that it's not violence that is the norm and peace that is an interjection or a cessation of that, but that the shalom community of peace is the norm God established, and that that is a reality, and our calling is to see that brokenness and find ways to restore that reality, but not to yield to the society's understanding of violence as being the norm.
So when you talk about rejecting idealism, you just mean believing in idealism enough to make it realistic?
Well, I don't think it is idealism in the sense that it's euphoric or unreal.
In other words, by looking at the people who are hungry, by looking at the nations who are about ready to annihilate each other and all the other problems, by believing that that can be overcome, is that idealistic or realistic?
Well, okay, I wasn't saying that it can be overcome by a certain thing or not overcome by a certain thing, but that for me the fundamental assumption is that God's order and God's intention was peace, and that the fact that those things exist speak to how severely that norm has been broken, but that doesn't necessarily define reality, the reality.
Yeah, I'm just curious, when he says reject the idea of idealism, exactly what does he mean? Well, exactly how do you interpret that?
Well, he's saying that it is idealistic to say anything other than violence is a natural part of the order and that it is the norm for our existence. When he says it's the same as the order of digestion or falling bodies or gravitation, I mean, to me, I don't think of something as gravitation is going to be overcome. We do defy it in our ability to do different things. But God created a world where gravitation was the norm. I don't think God created a world in which violence is intended to be the norm.
Turnier, in his book on violence within, says the same thing. It's just this normless apple pie, and it's just the natural way that we are and how we can't be overcome.
Do you agree with that?
No. I sure don't.
I sure don't either.
It looks like it.
I think
it looks like it, but see, that's what really, at least for me, gets me going, is that makes me believe there's got to be a different way to see things that is both realistic and visionary, instead of just saying, well, that's what it looks like, and that must be the way God made us to be.
Well, see, I think you can say that that's the way it is without saying that that's what God intends.
Okay, well, when I say what's normative, I'm thinking... Go ahead.
When you use the terms realistic and idealistic, I think what Janet is saying is that it's idealistic to think that violence is going to solve problems. It's realistic to call violence for what it is and not an answer to these things. But we're constantly told when you seek an alternative to violence, you're not being realistic. You don't understand the way the world is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's helpful.
In conversations with people about, you know, whether people are really capable of getting past war, when I stop and think of all the occasions in which we don't name it nonviolence, but that's exactly how we're solving conflicts, we've decided that within our national borders, we will not resolve conflicts. We don't condone conflict resolution by means of violence, except for the police and the penal system, and you could name some other things. But in terms of city councils, you know, the functions of a lot of the ordering of our lives together, that's nonviolence. And so many people think that nonviolence is almost against human nature. But most of our human interactions are nonviolent. Mm-hmm. When you really pause and look at the means of resolving differences, and people, I think it is a different way of seeing it. If you help people begin to see that they act nonviolently every day, mm-hmm. And it's a matter of what you're trained into a lot.
Uh-huh.
But and I people think are scared. Well, really have a hard time seeing that. So I think that's a really good point.
But it's interesting, the children who grow up in a different culture have bring a different normative sense to different conflicts. And I think all that is, what that teaches me and why this is important to me about peace education is that, but it's like the old saying that the woman wrote, children learn what they live. The child grows up understanding that he or she can expect a certain type of situation and to deal with it in a certain way. That's normative. That is what is normal. And if somebody else comes and hits the child and grabs their toys and kicks them, that's not normal. But right now, those are real normal things in a lot of situations.
An extreme example of that was this morning's public broadcasting that Israel bombed, who did they bomb?
France.
This was Israel yesterday. They bombed, I forget who
they bombed. They bombed somebody.
But they said, everybody will understand our need for revenge and for doing this. It was just simply a state of, I mean, everybody knows that if you get hit, you go out and hit somebody back. Or that when, in Time magazine, when they talked about Grenada and that how it was against international law, a statement is made that the only law that there really is that we have to pay attention to is world opinion. And for the most part, the world thought it was perfectly okay to really do that, and therefore we did not break an international law.
That's
untrue.
Yeah.
And that just shows you how
can I just back up to the last comment? Did you say that this person was stipulating that violence was an in kind of a as common as apple pie in a person?
It's all through me,
you know, I in a way almost kind of agree with him, because in my, although, you know, I'm very committed to nonviolence, I also have to recognize that there's a lot of violence in me. And in the way I treat myself, and in the way I relate to other people, and in just in a lot of things about me, and I struggle with that. Not saying that that's the right way to do things, but I do think that that's a portion of me, and I think of many that, well, personally I don't like it, but it is something that is very, well, it's a valid emotion.
Well, now, to me, there's a distinction between, and maybe you wouldn't agree with this, there's a distinction between having aggression and having frustration and having a lot of different emotions. Violence, to me, is not an emotion.
Okay. What do you do?
The way that I usually understood it, and I guess the way a more, quote-unquote, fundamental church might state it would be, one, like violence, the product of a fallen character, and not non-violence, the product of God's spirit overcoming your fallen nature. I don't know the validity of all that, and it's really not important, but the way, a lot of times, I've understood it, is that when I encounter a situation, there's two things I can do. I can retaliate in violence, or I can forgive in love. And for me, the balance between nonviolence or violence centers and balances on my attitude, whether or not I'm going to be self-centered or God and man-centered, as to whether or not, if I've been violated and I'm self-centered, then I'm going to go back and pay you back for it. If I am centered on love, whether you violate me or not, I will try not to respond in like fashion, but overcome with love. And so I think it just depends. And I think, in my opinion, people, by and large, tend to be self-centered. And that's why when you take their food, they're likely to kill you for it. Because they want to survive. They're not so concerned about you, they want to survive. And that's, in my understanding, the difference between a Christian and a non-Christian, or anyone else who loves the principle of life. The Christian will say, your life is as important as mine. And if you take my food, I'm not going to kill you for it. I'd like you to share it, and I'd like to share it with you. And that's the difference I see, that the Christian is the one who does not love himself, but loves God and loves those around him, and the non-Christian. And that can fall, and there are other religions and other beliefs that encompass that too. I don't want to be exclusive. But the one who turns away from God is the one who's self-centered and says, I'm going to fight to live. I don't care about you guys. That's, you know.
I want to let you go on with your thing, but I do want to draw one tie to what Marilyn was saying, that there, we have so much opportunity to live nonviolently, we do so much, and the tie between that and the ideology of fragmentation that you've been talking about, that it's, I think we can do it so many times among ourselves, among our municipal governments, because we know each other, but when we have an ideology of fragmentation that says those out there who we don't know are different than us and there's something to be feared about them, that removes us from that realm of possibly acting that way. And breaking down that ideology, whether it's by pairing off with a town in the Soviet Union or some way connecting with the humanness of the other people, is how we break through that fragmentation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it seems to me that if you ever stop and recognize in how you're dealing with conflict that, or at least I should speak for myself, that I am not acknowledging both my relatedness and my dependence on that other person, there's a fragment and the wholeness that could be cannot be. Another thing that I think our society right now is really having a hard trouble with in terms of demythologizing imagery and stuff is that we've always had an attitude of war being a defined, purposeful occurrence between nameless, faceless soldiers of the enemy. And that just is not going to be the case if we have a nuclear exchange. That's just not the way things are anymore. We don't deal with non-combatants. We deal with nuclear war is not going to. That's just not going to be the case. It's not even going to be possible, I don't think. There are quite a few military people who will argue that nuclear weapons, not only do they increase the ability for this to be true, but they perfect it because they are so precision-oriented that they can hit a specific spot in a specific way.
The Western Hemisphere.
Right. A specific continent, per se. But even at the very best, we would never be able to control fallout and the ecological effects for the rest of creation. To me, that's a farce to believe that. Anyway, so what we need to be about when we talk about peace, when we live things out, when we check things out in our behavior, is addressing how are we looking at things? Are we looking at things with eyes of vision, with eyes towards the interrelatedness and the interdependence of society, or are we being fooled by different kinds of mythologies and mystiques of war? I think in our society that we have a lot of trouble seeing things differently because violence has been so institutionalized and so relativized. Marilyn brought up the courts and the police, and that's up for grabs, I'm sure, for a lot of people about where the violence ends and the justice is beginning. But we've incorporated all sorts of violence, not only in our language, but just in our conventional wisdom. Most people do say that they embody violence, and so they are by nature a violent person. And I just really question that, and in terms of how I deal with children and how I would want to raise children if I had them, would be to like Kirk said, acknowledge the feelings of aggression, of pain, of hurt, of frustration, of that desire to get somebody back, but then to name what it is that's going on and not name it as violence that the person embodies and is intrinsic to their nature, because I don't believe God made us that way. And I don't think Scripture teaches that. Also, we have a mythology about the expertise and the knowledge of the experts that I think is really destructive for our society. We leave everything up to the people who know what they're doing. And if you read books like Nuclear War, What's in It for You, and basically someone who's saying, who's been on the inside, who's been doing these kinds of things, wait a minute, there's nobody in this room of experts who knows what's going on. And the public needs to hear that. And I think that we need to be to each other the kind of challenge that says, well, you can know just as much. You can find out. There's relatively a very small percentage of things that are top secret. It's hard to get certain kinds of information, maybe because it's misdirected and because some people don't want things public, but I don't think that it's helpful for us to always talk about leaving things up to the experts and saying, well, this is only my opinion because I really don't know, because it's a way of allowing us to just be inoculated and immobilized when we really do have other options.
With congregation and serving in Albuquerque, we had bomb elders and other members.
Wow.
And that was a common argument, that if you knew the information that we know, then you would not be opposing what we are doing. You know, that they want, you know, a lot of us to feel like, oh, we're stupid, and that we don't have the inside information.
If they had the outside information we
had. Or perspective.
That's,
yeah, interesting. I think it's true.
In the military, some of that, the higher ups, when you first get in the military, you think like those, like they really know what they're doing. Like they really, this is extremely ordered and structured environment, extremely disciplined, and there's just, you know, it's all works. And if anything goes wrong, it's immediately taken care of. The longer you stay in, the more you realize that even the highest, you know, generals and people that come in that are supposed to be so impressive are just as fallible and just as illogical. And it's, when I first went in the Marine Corps, I thought that it would be a good environment because I thought everything is dealt with very quickly and openly in a very disciplined fashion. After 6 years, you can watch people in the military do things for the stupidest reasons, with the blindest attitudes. And they have so much power, you know, in terms of a general that controls all the forces of the military for a sector of the world. And he is just another person. He's another human being like anybody here. And he has misconceptions and emotions that affect his decisions, so they're not rational. Mm-hmm. But he's been given so much destructive power. It's just, you know, he says do it, and he's got a couple hundred thousand people that have got, you know, and they'll do it.
And if we were more attuned to that mythology or that aura of professionalism and expertise, and it reminds me of those buttons that were real popular for a while, question authority. I think that is, it's part of demythologizing the processes and the systems that we live under and within.
One more thing is that in a business on the outside, if you're not capable of doing your job, you won't get promoted. On the military, all you've got to do is stay in, just re-enlist, and ultimately you'll be in charge, regardless of your capabilities. You'll be in charge.
Which says a lot about the kinds of people that are 30 years later generals.
Right.
Right, could and say, it doesn't necessarily say.
Not necessarily, but yeah, a lot of people there just because nobody else was there to fill the hole. They stayed in longer.
Well, I think in terms of that knowledge thing and experts, I'm almost starting to get angry at the idea that we even need to inform ourselves to be able to say that spending $600 billion for weapons that can obliterate the planet. I mean, I don't need to offer rational arguments to say that that's not okay.
And I feel like writing these really naive letters to the president, please do not end the planet. I mean, and not even bothering to justify that. I mean, why would you want to have to justify that? It's just, I mean, when the risk is that great, it seems to me ridiculous to even talk about informing yourself about it. Who needs to? You just know that that's not.
Well, yeah, but in terms of dealing with the powers that be, and you,
but
you
I
write
think
your
you
senator.
Deal with them that way. I just think even trying to argue on that level just feeds into it, because obviously they have a very well put together mythology. If they can even conceive of doing that, I mean, there's no way. I would argue that there's no way to crack that.
You could have
in
to
a
what's the alternative?
Way.
You'd have to get through another means other than words.
Yeah.
Well, what comes to mind is the passing recently of the end of the moratorium on making chemical and binary weapons. Mm-hmm. Now, I do think that you have to be somewhat informed, because that having that past, if you don't know what a chemical and binary weapon is, doesn't mean diddly to you. You know, why write your senator about something if you don't even know what it is that they passed? Well, who cares?
Well,
I mean, I think that there's probably there's a huge amount of our population that doesn't know we're making laser weapons for space.
I guess
doesn't do anything about it because we just don't know.
I guess if this is what Holly's saying, if nothing else is what I'm saying.
Well, that's great. Either way, it's significant.
We'll decide later whether we're in solidarity. is that to argue on the level? So often it seems like the approach of the peace movement is to argue against nuclear weapons, argue about them as point by point, fact by fact, as if we could piece together a rational argument against them. Well, at that point,
which grants their arguments rationality and integrity.
Yeah. I guess my feeling is that it's such an irrational situation that to rationally, I mean, I'm not gonna point by point. I trust that there's enough brains in the Pentagon to come up with some crazy. I mean, there is a mythology there. And I'll just relate one quick story that I guess was really profound as far as my understanding about that. Was we had the Assistant Secretary of State come to our school about 3 years ago and speak. And we were talking about nuclear weapons and such, and he was talking about how we needed to get the MX because our land-based missiles were vulnerable. And one of the students asked, well, why don't we just get rid of the land-based missiles? And he goes, well, we couldn't do that because we need a triac. And the student goes, first of all, his reply was, I never thought of that. And then he quickly gathered up his thoughts and said, no, we couldn't do that because we need a triac. The student asks, well, why do we need a triac? And he goes, well, the Joint Chiefs of Staff say that we need a triad, so therefore we must need one.
Oh, no.
That is
good.
Can't argue within that realm.
No, you can't. No. Not in get anywhere.
And so I guess my answer then is the way that your strongest argument is just maybe an alternative.
But at some point, I think you're living an alternative as got to have some sort of a statement and possibly an effect, well, I think it will have an effect, on the systems that make those decisions. You can't opt out and say, I'm not going to deal with this.
No,
I'm not going to opt out.
No,
I'm not saying that.
You never lower yourself to their realm. I mean, that sounds real elitist. But, you know, you don't say, well, I'll do this, even though I don't believe this. I'll argue on this. I'll convince it because, and I think at that point you're really losing sight of Shalom.
Uh-huh.
Well, if nothing else, you have to be, I think there's being informed is important, if nothing else, is to the ability to inform other people. Mm-hmm. Just because if nobody was informed, then we wouldn't be informed.
Well,
yeah.
I guess it's just...
I understand what you're saying, but I think...
It's just a fine line. I mean, it can be so overwhelming.
Right.
That we just give up.
I think there's a real validity, right, with the sense you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, not just specifically pointing up what it is that you're concerned about from a value orientation. It's
no,
just
it's
as valid.
Okay. It's just not okay. Please stop it.
Yeah. Go for it, Holly.
I think what you're the power of questions. I had a friend during the Vietnam War that was so committed to war protests, he went house to house to argue with people, up and down streets to argue with people about the war. This wasn't working, so he changed his strategy. Just knocked on a house and said, I'm all confused about the Vietnam War, and I'd like you to explain to me what it's all about. Could you help me? And he talked more people out of the Vietnam War by just having them try to.
Wow. How disarming.
Writing for a Congress people and everything, they just write questions.
But see, I agree with that, what Holly's saying, but I think what Steve's saying too, you do that out of a context of being informed so that when they write back their stupid little rhetorical doodly twat, you can piece through it and get...
Is that
you're
still going to kill people?
Yeah, you ask the second round. You just expose the farce for what it is. Exactly.
That's precisely the question you
returned. You just expose the farce for what it is.
So that you have to keep in mind that people can be misguided and still, you know, they're in power and they're misguided, but they're still people. And I think if they think that you have no respect for their thinking and things like that, then they're just going to write you off. They're going to say, if you don't desire to understand what I'm saying, then I don't want to talk to you. And I know relationship relies on communication. And if you show them, I understand what you're saying, but I disagree with it, and accept the fact that they've thought it through, accept the fact that they believe, even if they're misguided, they're more often likely to listen, I think. And if I try to deal with somebody that doesn't even get into the way I think, then I'm going to think, but you don't even bother me. I think if I think, hey, you've looked at what I thought, you've thought about it, you've shown respect for what I believe, but you disagree, I'd be more willing, from their point, they would be more willing to listen to someone who is ready to deal with them where they're at. Because I could be in power and I could be misguided and I could say, well, you guys don't understand, you're not even looking at this. You could come back and say, yes, I have looked at it. And I understand all this, but I disagree. So sometimes you need to talk to them on a level. I think it's both ways.
I think there's a fine line between being informed and stating with a sense of rationality what is an expression of your value orientation and what your commitment is, and from you know, where you are on the fragment list, then, like Eric was talking, getting into a rational discussion devoid of other assumptions that maybe you would hold true that they would not hold true.
Yeah, well, truth is very simple, but sometimes you got to show them that you do seek to understand. You know, like you can put the truth into a few words, like,
and that's always important to keep in mind where your faith's at. And I think it's really easy when you start trying to convince people with point by point political arguments that it's a real great risk to put a whole lot more faith. Mm-hmm. And first of all, a responsibility apart from yourself, and second of all, probably more seriously, a faith in something that I think, at least myself, has decided it's not going to work. I mean, my firm belief is the nuclear question is not going to be solved by the politicians. I mean, it's not going to be decided one day in Congress.
Well, the decision may not be made in Congress at first, but eventually I think it will have to be made in Congress.
Well, I think Congress will,
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it makes you wonder at a government that can write off a million people marching in a city of New York as being the radical fringe.
Yeah.
I mean, a million people being all communists inspired a radical
fringe.
Well,
it's also the communists and
that's
what they got in the last election.
Yeah.
handful of communists all brought all their friends.
Something about talking to people that, especially in talking with ROTC students and students in general, I had one conversation with a fellow that really convinced me of an approach. I'm sure it doesn't always work, but we were talking for a while. I happened to be dressed in clown makeup, so he couldn't keep up with me. He wasn't recognizing me right off the bat, and he finally. He said, are you Marilyn Fenn? And he had read some articles I'd written. And we'd been having this conversation. He says, frankly, I'm very surprised you're even listening to me. He says, I assumed from your political position that you wouldn't have the time of day for me. And then we started talking about, I'm convinced that the opposite of violence is creativity. And I think that something that reaffirms that over and over is the stupidity of the ways that we're going about being in the world as a national entity. And so this man who's in ROTC, and then I started trying it with other, you know, people who would really be afraid of the communists. But to talk about historical examples of where nonviolence was used and worked, and then to talk about nonviolent interventionary forces. The UN is trying to organize one from Namibia. There's one being organized along the border of Nicaragua. And the people in the military are committed to more military values. Really got excited about those things, and it was something we could mutually imagine together. Mm-hmm. It wasn't pitting my values against their values, but we could both say we want peace, we want life affirmed. I mean, there's tons of common ground between military and non-military folks. And if you can find some way to create the conversation or shape the conversation in a way where you're both talking to each other rather than just, you know, talking at each other, those are the most exciting conversations that I've had with people that I thought I wouldn't have much to agree with about, and that I'm sure they felt the same way. But I think that, well, they have to feel that you accept and respect their position too.
And that goes back to that sense of being tied to them. And, you know, if you can write someone off, you don't feel related to them.
Yeah. Then you're playing the same game. That's the basis of the whole problem.
Something to remember, too, on what you said, that the people in the military have families, too. I mean, the military community is a community, and they don't want the war any more than anyone else. That's just the way, though, that they see to solve the problem is to kill the enemy. But they all have families, and they all have kids, and they all have... They don't want war any more than anyone else.
Wouldn't they even say more it's to deter the enemy?
Yeah, basically, it's like, we want peace just as much as you do, but if you threaten our peace, well, you know, we're going to come back.
No, but they're saying what hopefully they're doing is being
That's their intent.
Not being able to kill the enemy.
There are very few people in the military that are there because they want to go to war.
Yeah. But the thing about people in the military that I don't find as common in the peace movement is they're willing to die for their commitment. And peaceniks have never, or haven't taken it that far in a life situation. I mean, if we're really going to talk, I mean, I really respect that about everyone in the military. They're prepared to die for their values and for what they, you know, they're willing to defend what they believe in with their life. And I think peacenics would start, you know, acting differently and being perceived differently if we were willing to take the same risk. And there are people who do that. I mean, I'm not saying that there are.
Sometimes it's more easy to believe in the power of a weapon than the power of love. Because you can see that a weapon will stop your enemy. The power of love may not.
We just have a practice.
Last time I was out of the village, it happened to be the home anniversary of the Marine Corps.
Was it November? Mm-hmm. November 10th, Marine Corps birthday.
Yeah. And I sat in front of the television and just sweat. It was an hour program. And they had about a 20-minute segment showing the Marine boot camp. And they first of all, they interviewed Marines who said, this is not a job, it's a way of life. We know that we all have to die sometime, and so we'd rather die for something honorable, which is dying for our country. And then they showed a dummy like a man lying on the ground, and these men took turns coming up and stabbing it with a bayonet through its neck, while everybody sat around yelling, kill, kill, kill. If that's a way of life, I mean, I just can't imagine, after watching what they are trained to do, what kind, would you care to speak to how that affected you, or was that part of your experience? Or?
Yeah. On the outside, the view of the military is very different than on the inside. On the outside, if they told you what went on in boot camp, nobody would support it. The outside, you have justice and truth and democracy in the American way and all the very lofty, noble things that we're fighting for, and that nobody wants to fight, but somebody has to know how, and the different statements they use. But once you're inside boot camp,
They want you to be willing to obey an order without question, and they want you to believe that you are probably the most formidable military force in the face of the earth. And they showed films in boot camp of wars, and they would make statements like that you're giving your enemy the chance to give his life for his country, and things, you know, basically teach you. They want you to want to kill. We practice things, you know, simulating combat with weapons and things, and just a chance while you're running, they would chant songs about killing, about, you know, destroying. They would make jokes about using how it was bad that they took away the flamethrower because, you know, different things, how it was a really good weapon, and they talked about dying in living color, or dying color. They take color movies that they would show about wars and dying color. Just the thing is, they want you to destroy. They want you to want to destroy. They talk about gory things, and everybody's supposed to yell "Hoorah!" which is a big gutsy, and everybody gets hyped to go out and kill a commie for your country, you know, it's just like they want you to get to agree that you are a formidable fighting machine and that nothing can stand in your way. And just to be so hyped up on that if somebody declares war on you, you're going to go out and wipe them out. And we practice all sorts of things.
Were they successful? Do they actually...
Oh, during boot camp, yeah.
During boot camp, I mean, but...
After boot camp, it changes. No. After you get out, you begin to be back in the real world again. But when you first get out of boot camp, you are different. You're changed. You're very committed to that. The boot camp was 78 training days long. And you do what they say. Most people just got into it. They just didn't think about it. I mean, it's such a high-tension disciplinary environment. If you do not do exactly what you're told to do, exactly when you're told to do it, you're in a great amount of trouble and you're punished severely. By the time you got a boot camp, you would kill somebody if they told you to, if you believed that it went along the lines of warfare. If it was a legitimate order, you'd kill somebody because you were told to. You were trained to, your attitude was like that, and you'd do it because it was right.
Sounds to me like you can brainwash a person and direct their whole value orientation in 78 days.
We hit boot camp, and the night we hit boot camp, we got a 30-second haircut and all our clothes taken away. So we're all standing around. When we're on the bus, you have everybody from every different kind of thing, you know. A little while later, you had everybody looking exactly the same, standing in exactly the same uniforms, and you've lost your identity. You're now a group, okay? They train you to not question authority, not question orders. Do what you're told. If he says jump, you ask how high on the way up, and then ask permission to come down. Do what you're told when you're told. You don't question anything. If you fail to do, on the first third of boot camp, you've already failed. By the time they told you to do it, you've already messed it up. I mean, they're just hazing you. You're in so much trouble all the time. The second third of boot camp, you're doing pretty good, but you still fail a lot. By the third thing in boot camp, you're pretty tight. The unit will do what they tell you to do. I mean, they just want to do. They've gotten to the point where they like working together as a unit. They like being powerful. They like being aggressive. They're taught to be aggressive. They're taught to follow orders. You know.
So violence is really...
It's
fostered in.
Yes,
they want you
to be willing to kill. They want you to be willing to destroy. They don't want you to question going out and shooting anyone. The Marines have the best reputation of any military service, and they have done extremely well in wars because they go at a war and at violence with this is right, and I will overcome even if I die doing it. We are the best. We are the toughest. We're number one. Nobody can stop us. And they teach you in boot camp how in the Chosen Reservoir of the Army, two divisions of Army personnel got bogged down, and a couple of platoons of Marines fought their way in, took all the Army's wounded and all their stuff, and fought their way back out when they went in mechanized. And it's true, they did it. You know? And so you get this thing like, I'm a Marine. There's nothing that can stop me.
And they know how hated they are, most of all.
Well, they're feared. There's some countries that
not even
fight.
Feared, that's hated.
Yeah. In Vietnam, if you could come back with the Marines dog tags, if you're an enemy soldier, and you could come back with the Marines dog tags, you were rewarded if they had Marine on them. Because the Marines are just, they're the first to go in, they need no declaration of war. They have the longest boot camp, the toughest things. They do more man hours per man with less dollars per man than any other service. And you are trained to not question the morality of warfare. You just do what you're told. And if you don't, you're in trouble.
I think it's a really complex task before us in terms of demythologizing, because we have a number of institutions that shape our socialization. But in terms of the military, if you can generalize what you're saying as the case and the experience, and it seems to be what it is, then we take what are natural human emotions and create the kind of functioning units we want for a totally different value orientation. Mm-hmm. Isn't it? And that has so seeped into society that we believe we are violent people. You know.
Well, it's funny how, just one more thing, and that's it. What the boot camp experience is designed to do is to produce a very effective military organization. It's designed to produce a unit of men who will go to combat and who will give their absolute utmost. It is interesting to note that in order to produce an effective military, you have to abandon the teachings of love, the teachings of peace, the teachings of truth, pretty much, because those don't add to an effective military organization. You have to add the teaching of power, the teaching of discipline, the teaching of subordination.
Replace love with honor.
And obedience without question, and honor in obedience. And so you take a society that's based on principles, and you take men out of that society that are going to be trained to preserve that society, you put them into a boot camp, and you teach them none of those principles. You teach them, on the other hand, violence, obedience without question. No, what goes into the training of a military organization, you're trying to teach them to be a perfect military unit, and you don't want anything to distract them from their primary mission, which is to go out and overcome militarily by force. And if you were to go, I mean, it would take really men of high integrity to put them into a boot camp and say, this is all wrong, but we're going to have to do it. You know, the just war theory, they don't teach the just war theory in boot camp.
Yeah, I agree that that's the way it certainly seems to be done in this country. I wonder, though, and I don't want to be plugging for a good kind of military, but I look at the Nicaragua and the Sandinistas, where it was very, I mean, there was a tremendous emphasis on loyalty and all that, but also tremendous emphasis all the way through on forgiveness of the enemy. When you got, I mean, what they did with the National Guard of Nicaragua once they won, basically forgiving, abolishing capital punishment. I mean, this whole sense of, we've been pushed to the wall, this is our last response, we don't want to do this, we didn't want to do this.
Right.
It's such a different ethic than training a military terrorist guard to protect vested interests throughout the world. When we talk about stopping terrorism, we forget that we're the number one terrorist country in the world. And our Marines, and I'm just not meant to any person, but our Marines are our most effective terrorist, you know,
right,
group. And,
well, that's the thing, like I said, when you get out of boot camp, you lose that.
Well, we don't even have that in our society. I mean, how many people, I don't think many of us think in our society the Marines as being terrorists, but
that's,
they are in the rest of the world. It is.
Language in the military.
We're mythologizing. You know what? People, and that's why I say people outside, we think of them as really being honorable people that go and liberate countries. But these countries that get liberated against their own will don't think of them that way.
Well, you're using
every
the same
country in Latin America
with a different principle. You're saying, we're going to use the same tactics you use, only we're going to do it for honorable principles and honorable reasons.
But legitimate.
And it doesn't fool anybody who's on the receiving end. All those countries in Latin America who have been invaded time and time after again this century, I mean, they're not the least bit surprised that Grenada was invaded, and they will be very surprised if Nicaragua isn't invaded.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are a terrorist country that goes around terrorizing smaller nations. It's so clear. We just can't see it in this country, but once you get out of this country, it's obvious.
Well, if you taught the just war theory, if you taught all the intellectual arguments in boot camp, half the people wouldn't pick up their weapons.
I think the justifiable war criteria in the mainline churches is just a sham.
It's a way to rationalize. Mm-hmm. You take people who are not trained on the just war theory to fight, and then when they go out and fight, you rationalize what they're doing with the just war theory.
Yeah.
Well,
you
say,
I think in its inception it wasn't that, but in practice and history, that's what.
Well, it never, the just war theory never had the idea that you'd have a standing army of 2 million people. I mean,
go ahead,
well, something that clicked for me recently was I don't know how many people in this room saw the movie Officer and a Gentleman.
Yeah.
Did very many people see that movie? Well, I saw it like a year and a half after it came out. And part of the reason I went to see it is because it had gotten such good reviews and it was about values and all this kind of stuff. So I went to see it and it describes a young man entering into boot camp and his relationship with women and all this kind of stuff. And I think what I picked up, which was really terrifying for me, was that somehow we have a country that doesn't have any values, or it's sort of shifting its values and doesn't know what it's going about. So they looked at this model of this person being welded into this community of, you know, people who are concerned about honor and all this kind of stuff, and celebrated that, and celebrated this real Cinderella myth about rescuing this woman from, you know, poverty and all this kind of stuff. And within that, it works okay, except that I came to it with values that didn't fit, and I was absolutely horrified that that movie was being touted as having anything to do with anything. I mean, it was so discouraging and disillusioning that a movie that it does talk about values and does talk about relationships and stuff, but in the context of murdering people, racism, gross sexism, abusing women, I just went, where are we going? You know, I mean, the peace movement is really going to have to get its act together to have some model that can contend with that. Because what I kept hearing from people was that we need as a culture to have some model for discipline, for people standing up for values. And this is what we have. And I admire anybody that stands up for their values, but the problem is that the context is so screwed up. I mean, I guess Gandhi is an example of it, of another kind of movie that people are going to see, but I was horrified that Officer and a Gentleman was even, that people would even go to see it. It was so, so terribly, terribly violent and racist. I mean, just stuff that dredged up all kinds of stuff that I thought we were long gone, far beyond, and celebrated it and made a lot of money off of it. I was just appalled.
This is on a different tack, but I just want to mention this too. I wonder, and I don't want to make a generalization because I know this isn't true of all military families, but some of our best friends were in military. And our first parish was basically military people. But there was a group from a base up here at Holden with a chaplain, a bunch of Lutheran people, and there was a little boy sitting in a high chair at the end of the table in the dining hall. And every time his father looked at him, the kid just jerked and put his hands over his face and he'd start to eat, and the father would turn around and look at him. He didn't do anything to him, but the kid just recoiled from his father's touch or his looking at him. And I asked the chaplain about it. I said, "What is there a problem in the family?" He said, "Yeah, there is. It's almost certain that the child was abused." He said, "You know, that's most of my counseling, but there is a higher incidence of child abuse in the military than any other place in the United States, and a very, very high percentage.
50% higher. And rape is 3 times as high on military bases and around military bases."
It's interesting if you make the connection with what Jim said.
Rape is 3 times as high, and spouse abuse is double.
I didn't mention in boot camp, but the morality as far as sexual relationships is, boot camp is one of the most worldly places I've ever been. They got songs about killing, they got songs about women, they got songs about everything. It's just, you know, it's a worldly place. The leaders that train your fighting men are not really that respectable.
I've been sitting back here, I probably went through boot camp a long time before Jim did, and
they were still singing the same songs, right?
Don't knock your armed forces too much, because where would you be if we didn't have armed forces?
Well, I guess the kinds of things I'm trying to bring up is that not only United States type people, but Christians around the world, from my perspective, if we're true to our identity as creations, and if we're honest about what Scripture calls us to, maybe there would be a need for a spontaneous defense of something on some other sort of aggression. But in the way the world looks now, the fact that we have standing armies to protect us from people who look like us, breathe like us, and act like us around the world is a sign of the brokenness, and it shouldn't be as accepted as norm and said, you know, well, that's a fact of life, and, you know, where would we be if we didn't have it? I wonder if where we'd be if we didn't have it might be, if it's not worth the risk in terms of our faith.
Biggest argument we had in the military over whether it's a war, right or not, was people argued that without an army, you cannot defend your home, you cannot defend your family, and that's true. It's not a real simple issue. If you've ever seen your family murdered, if you've ever been in a country where those things go on, it's not that simple. You might want a military. The thing that with me was, you can't defend your home, you can't defend your family, you can't defend your food, you can't defend your rights without a military. But the Christian has the promise that this family, this home, this food, these rights are minor things if you will live with God, ultimately. Would you be willing to allow somebody to take away your life? You know, without a weapon, I may not be able to stop you from taking all that I own, but is all that I own worth killing you for? If I have a promise from God, if I have faith, really, that God will justify me in the end, and that my life with God will far surpass my life here, if I really believe that, if I'm convinced of the quote-unquote inheritance, then it's not this life that I'm trying to defend. You can't take my life from me. You can't take from me anything that's of any value. Because the only thing that is really of value is my life, and God's got that. And so that's true. Without a military, you may lose everything you own.
A lot of people lose that every day of the week, though, with and without militaries in all sorts of countries, and it's not...
But should you kill someone in order to maintain your possessions? We may not be a country. We wouldn't be a country if we didn't have a military.
We might be. How do we know?
Well, we were born through a revolution, okay? But...
Which is argued by some historians, if we had continued with the nonviolent tactics, we would have achieved our independence three years earlier than by the military.
Okay.
And that's our way of looking at history and so many things, that we're at a crisis point, that now's our chance to do it and to learn a new way.
Right.
Or
well, my point is just that, when you fight to preserve these things, is it God's desire? Is it right to kill in order to preserve? Would it not be better to lose the things that you have now